You care about helping others learn and grow, and now you can make an even greater difference. The Ohio State University's fully online master's in applied behavior analysis prepares you to help learners with disabilities thrive. You'll develop the skills to use evidence-based interventions that enhance learning outcomes and foster independence, all in a flexible format designed for working professionals. With growing demand for board-certified behavior analysts, this online program helps you prepare for what's next without pausing your life. If you're ready to expand your impact, Ohio State is ready to support your next step. Visit go.osu.edu/behavioranalysis.
This episode sponsored by Ridwell. Doing the right thing shouldn't be so hard, but when it comes to recycling, it often is. Ridwell makes it simple to recycle more from anywhere. With Ridwell, you can recycle plastic bags, snack wrappers, pill bottles, bottle caps, and other items your curbside bin doesn't take. And unlike most recycling programs, Ridwell carefully tracks where your items go and reports back on what actually gets recycled. Getting started is easy. Order a starter kit, fill the bags with hard-to-recycle items, send them back for free, and Ridwell takes care of the rest. Start today at ridwell.com.
And we're recording, right?
We are recording.
Awesome. Hello. Welcome to the Katie Halper Show.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, yeah. I'm Katie Halper, joined by...
Gabe Pacheco.
And we are so excited to be joined by...
John Pat Leary.
Yeah.
Sorry, I stepped
up. Oh, no. John Pat Leary.
Yeah, I thought this was, you're a professional comedian, Gabe.
That was a joke. Are we okay?
Yeah, I think okay. So.
Maybe as a second backup, do you have an iPhone you can just do voice memo on?
Yeah.
Great, thanks.
Hell yeah, we're all in the moment.
Yeah, this is great. You can see this is a very slick operation.
Yeah.
Silicon Valley. Okay, great. And it's a good thing that our guest was recording because, as you may hear from the quality of my voice as well as the voice of Gabe Pacheco, we had a bit of an issue recording from our end. The guest of whom I speak is none other than John Pat Leary, an associate professor of English at Wayne State University in Detroit. He is the author of A Cultural History of Underdevelopment, Latin America and the U.S. Imagination, as well as the book Keywords, The New Language of Capitalism, which is what we discussed with him on this episode. The book is a lexicon of the contemporary age of inequality, which decodes the new vocabulary of capitalism for a broad readership. So it basically functions as a glossary. The keywords all share a celebration of the decisive leadership, dreamy artistry, prophetic vision, and inexhaustible commitment to work, the pillars of an ideal, innovative self. Make sure you become Patreon supporters so you can hear John Pat Leary explaining why he wrote the book and reading some of his favorite terms from the book. Also, the newly relevant discussion I had with Matt Taibbi, which explains, and I can't believe we need to explain this in 2019, but if you haven't heard, Bernie Sanders is being called a conspiracy theorist because he suggested that maybe, just maybe, Jeff Bezos' ownership of the Washington Post may influence the coverage of him. So if you haven't already heard it, Walker Bragman and I sat down with Matt Taibbi and talked about how media censorship works and how it's not always explicit. Sometimes it is, but often it isn't. So go to patreon.com/the Katie Halper Show.
John Pat, you're calling us from Portugal?
That's right, yeah.
Hell yeah. So what time is it over there right now?
It's about 9 o'clock.
All right. Well,
PM.
Thank you for making time in your late evening for us.
Yeah. Are you
yeah.
about to eat dinner in a couple of hours?
Well, I'm not really on the local schedule for eating dinner at 9 o'clock, so no, I ate already.
So they must think you're kind of strange.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, it's difficult with small children that you don't want to feed them at 9 o'clock.
Well, do Portuguese kids just run around outside in the plazas until midnight?
I haven't really figured that out. I'm not totally sure about that. I think some do and some don't.
Right.
I love the Mediterranean lifestyle. I was in Greece a couple of years back, and I was in this plaza in Kalambaka, and all the kids were out until like 1 a.m., and the parents were just at the tables. And whenever a bored child came up and tried to talk to their parents, the parents would just open up a pack of cigarettes and have the kids count them.
I thought you were going to say would like smoke and blow smoke into their faces or something.
So, so they were learning. It was education.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it was a different parenting lifestyle.
Yeah, I'm trying to get into that general lifestyle
in Lisbon.
I'm teaching at the University of Lisbon. I have a Fulbright fellowship here.
That's fancy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, sort of fancy. Yeah, I like it a lot. I mean, I like living here a lot. It's a refreshing change to be in even what passes for a poor country in the EU. It's like so much, the quality of life is so much higher than in the United States.
It sounds like there's a lot of opportunities there to sort of innovate and be disruptive.
Yeah, create good content.
There are fewer that I can. I mean, that you know, innovação is a word that I've had to come across a few times, but it's not as ubiquitous as innovation is.
Oh, innovação, got it. Yeah. So when you get a Fulbright, you can either be teaching or doing research. Is that right?
Well, there's just different ones you apply to. So this was like a teaching one that is just at the University of Lisbon all the time. And I was eligible to apply for it. And I'd been to Portugal once and liked it. So it was kind of just a whim that it would be a fun place to spend 6 months.
Yeah, I was in Portugal. I really liked it. I was coming from Spain. I thought the people in Lisbon were much nicer than the people in Madrid, by the way.
Yeah, that's the reputation.
Yeah.
Because people in Madrid are snooty and think they own the world still or something.
I don't know if that's it. Have you been there?
I've never been there. I've just heard that here about people in Madrid.
I think they're surprisingly parochial in Madrid, and that maybe sounds problematic, and I've been accused once of orientalizing Spain, which I think is funny because I don't think that Said meant Jews talking about Spain when he wrote that.
I don't even know what parochial means in this context.
Narrow? What does professor, please tell us what it means.
It means narrow.
It means narrow, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. For a capital city, they're not that cosmopolitan. That's what I'll say. It's not their fault. They were living under dictatorship from 39 to 75. This is kind of problematic. But you know what? I feel like one of the few groups that I'm allowed to as a Jewess, you know, I can kind of make fun of Italians, kind of make fun of Spaniards, kind of make fun of Portuguese, Irish a little bit, not as much.
They had it pretty bad.
Right, they had it pretty bad. And Portuguese and Italians, well, Southern Italians have had bad stuff happen to them. Anyway, I'm just going to own it without worrying about whether it's problematic. I do think that Madrid, it's like, they have this interesting thing where they just call people slurs, like, to their faces. They also do this thing where if you order a meal and it's like a chicken and it comes with French fries and you just don't want the French fries, you don't even want a substitute. You just don't want the fries. They're like, "Es imposible que no se hace." They just like can't do it. It's just not done. And then,
they're not nimble in the way they take orders.
No, not at all. Yeah. That's what
kind of obtuse.
I kind of appreciate that, though. Why would you not want the French fries?
Well, it's true, and I think that maybe that's a good, like, body image, healthy attitude.
They're like, tío, ¿por qué no puedes dar esos papas fritas a alguien?
Yeah, it's true.
You can just hand them out, man.
It's true, yes, in the closet, yeah.
That's what happens with me. Anytime people give me, like, a treat, I never say no, I take it. You offer me a piece of gum, I'll take it. And then I'll just, you know, hand it off later as sort of goodwill currency.
Right. What if they offer you something with nuts?
That's right. I just say thank you very much. If it's in packaging, I keep it.
You keep it, and hand it back to someone not allergic.
And then I give it to a homeless person later.
Right.
Or an unintended child.
Yeah.
I don't care.
But do you ask them if they have allergies?
Often.
Often, but not. Sometimes you like to throw a curveball. Yeah. Especially if there's not an EpiPen. It really raises the
It's
the
really
state.
Like testing people's life skills.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. How resourceful they are. So tell us what you're doing you're teaching right now in Portugal.
I'm just teaching these two classes. One of them is like a kind of introduction to American culture for undergraduates, and another is a class on Marxism, but I didn't really tell the State Department that that's what I was going to be teaching, so.
Uh-oh, there are a lot of State Department fans up there, so you can't get out of yourself.
Yeah, I think they're listening.
So don't tag the Fulbright Foundation or anything in the tweet that you do.
So how did you get interested in Marxism? Because this is kind of a neo-communist manifesto, right?
Well, that's flattering. I mean, I got into it in college, I guess. Well, really high school. I mean, not Marxism in high school. I didn't really read it at that level in high school. But, like, you know, just it was the sort of
Spectre.
The Yeah, it was like the way to be intellectually like rebellious, I guess. So it's what I got into in college.
This is a little like maybe some background that John Pat and I were at the same all boys Catholic school in sixth and seventh grade, and we had to do we got confirmed. Were we in the same confirmation?
No, class? No, no. I didn't get confirmed. You got confirmed, but I wasn't. I was never actually baptized, so I wasn't eligible to be confirmed.
Whoa!
Did you rebel?
You're still going to hell?
Yeah.
No, I was in the the. You know, when you were in the confirmation class doing your catechism or wherever you did there, I was in the class with all the Protestants and the Jewish kid in our class. And
oh, okay, you know. Yeah. But I remember. So one thing I do remember that at St. Anselm's in that class, we watched the Raul Julia's presentation of Archbishop Romero, and okay. So there was on some level at St. Anselm's this. understanding of liberation theology. Like, it wasn't hardcore, but we did get a taste of it. And we also had watched The Mission, which was Robert De Niro's take as a slave trader in Brazil, I think.
Did you put in all the chilies?
I'm afraid I did. I'm sorry, I was trained as a mercenary, not as a cook.
This is true. This is dreadful.
Who then, you know, sees the light and fights.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Indigenous.
Father, I want to thank you for having me here.
You should thank the Guarani. Read this.
When I was a child, I spake as a child. I understood as a child. I thought as a child. But when I became a man, I put away childish things. But now abideth faith, hope, love, these three. But the greatest of these is love.
But did you also have the March for Life guy, the religion teacher?
Okay, so yeah, so St. Anselm's was this crazy petri dish of insane ideas as well. So we had... We did watch The Silent Scream at one point in a religious class.
I think I know a little bit about abortion. For a period of 2 years, I was the director of the largest abortion clinic in the Western world. Now, for the first time, we have the technology to see abortion from the victim's vantage point. We are going to watch a child being torn apart, dismembered, disarticulated, crushed, and destroyed by the unfeeling steel instruments of the abortionist.
And that was intense.
I think we should all, here and now, devote ourselves to an untiring effort to devise a better solution, a solution compounded equally of love and a decent regard for the overriding priority of human life. Let's all, here and now, stop the killing.
And also the Legionaries of Christ, which were the youth outreach portion of the Opus Dei, were coming into the school trying to get us at a young age.
Did they wear little things on their legs, the cuffs?
They didn't wear the cuffs. They just invited us out to go camping with them and play, what is it, capture the flag on golf courses in the suburbs.
and go to King's Dominion, the amusement park.
Yeah, they took us to King's Dominion. But, well, that was the bait.
Well, I didn't ever go. I wasn't allowed. My mom wouldn't let me go on an aunt, so.
Wait, so what's going on? You're Protestant or?
No, Protestant? I just I am a child of a mixed marriage, I guess. Catholic, Protestant, mixed marriage. My mom, you know, the local parish priest, thought my mother was wicked for having married outside the church. So we never went to church. And as a consequence, I was never baptized.
Oh, got it. So maybe that's what made you kind of Marx friendly, because you were already skeptical of religion. It wasn't that far from that to it's the opiate of the masses.
But I also think being Catholic makes you can make you susceptible to Marxism, because they're both sort of ornate, complicated, potentially socialist, ways of reading the world,
Right. ironic that he was a Jew turned Lutheran, but it all comes full circle. So how did you, this is, by the way, a really good book.
Thank you.
And, yeah, I've been following I've been following since Keywords for Austerity, I think the blog.
Yeah, I had to change the title to make it a little more reader friendly.
Sure. So I was following it on Facebook through that, and I always found your post to be hilarious. And like Ambrose Pierce's Devil's Dictionary.
Yeah, that was one of my models. I'm a big fan of Ambrose Pierce.
Yeah, and it also made me think about George Carlin and a lot of what George, you know, just going through old stand-up and him skewering euphemisms and sort of newspeak and ways that corporations like talk to us and to basically hide the truth.
So what were some of the ones he did? Do you remember?
He just had entire bits, but he had one later in his career. He had one bit that was like almost a slam poem, where he talks about being a modern man.
I'm a modern man, a man for the millennium, digital and smoke free, a diversified multicultural postmodern deconstructionist, politically, anatomically, and ecologically incorrect.
Who uploads and downgrades.
I've been uplinked and downloaded, I've been inputted and outsourced, I know the upside of downsizing, I know the downside of upgrading. I'm a high-tech lowlife, a cutting-edge, state-of-the-art, bi-coastal multitasker, and I can give you a gigabyte in a nanosecond.
And sort of he just uses every possible new term. He's like showing that he's hip to the new slang,
mm-hmm.
but by putting it all together in this big word salad, you see how absurd all of it is.
I'm new wave, but I'm old school, and my inner child is outward bound. I'm a hot-wired, heat-seeking, warm-hearted, cool customer, voice-activated and biodegradable. I interface with my database is in cyberspace, so I'm interactive, I'm hyperactive, and from time to time, I'm radioactive.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, that's basically a lot of my source material, like Bloomberg or Forbes.com and the Harvard Business Review.
Yeah.
It's kind of... It's kind of turned my brain to mush, I feel like, having, you know, researched the book and been so deep into stuff that is just basically at a fundamental level just kind of stupid, you know?
Right. Yeah, but you're writing about it in a smart way, obviously.
Well, thank you.
Can you explain your trajectory? Because it's interesting. You're an English professor.
Yeah.
Your first book was called A Cultural History of Underdevelopment, Latin America and the U.S. Imagination.
Yeah.
And now you've written this book, Keywords, The New Language of Capitalism. So what do these things have to do with each other? Are they a trajectory? Are they just disparate interests?
The English professor thing and this one seem to me not to be, that seems to be a coherent trajectory because, you know, it's about like the politics of language and how language is used and abused. And that's kind of, you know, part of teaching and studying literature. But the first one, I mean, the Cultural History of Underdevelopment book came out of my, you know, my doctoral dissertation. And it's, so it was more about, came out of interests I had at the time that were more oriented toward Latin America. But, you know, it's they're both about the evolution of certain, like, conventional ideas about the economy and the American economy. So in a certain way, they're about, like, the culture of wealth and poverty, I guess, and the way that those are understood and also strategically misunderstood.
Well, it's funny. I was just thinking about like extreme poverty and Howard Schultz wanted to.
Wealth people.
Yeah. He was like, let's call ourselves people of means, you know, because billionaires has become a new target for bullies.
Right.
So we're people of means or POMs, which kind of I see POMs, as a play on POCs, you know, POMs.
Right. Or you could say people of capital, and then it would be POC.
Yeah, you could do that, too.
You could. You could rebrand.
Yeah.
Yeah, he said people of, also people of wealth.
Yeah.
Which would be
POWs.
POWs.
That's great.
Which in an Ayn Randian worldview, they are being held captive by the unwashed masses.
Right, by the welfare state.
Yeah, you don't understand
the social safety net.
Yeah.
That stifles innovation.
We have to liberate capital.
And how did your how did you come up with this idea? What made you write it? And why did you? It's really cool because you write it as a kind of like a glossary.
Yeah.
What made you do that?
Well, so I mean, the glossary organization and the title are both kind of nods to Raymond Williams' book Keywords. You know, it's like the one of the classics of Marxist literary criticism from the 70s, and it was a book that's like, it's a lot different sort of in style and in tone than mine, but basically the premise that you can figure out a lot of what is fundamental or is powerful in a particular society by going to the language that is that circulates in that society, and by kind of like digging into it, you can language can function like a key, you know, and to open up a particular way of looking at the world. And so that's the inspiration. And then the more like immediate inspiration for the subject of the book, like to talk about these kind of what you might call buzzwords or, you know, like the language of innovation and entrepreneurship and so forth just came out of like my irritation with hearing all that stuff. So the book is like a labor of hate, kind of.
Right. LOH.
Yes.
You know, I just think about how in entertainment, at least, I would think of entertainers as sort of what they're one man corporations, and we're constantly in a freelance gig economy.
Mm-hmm.
And so this idea of having a personal brand has always been part of, we were the early adopters to using social media, early adopters to this sort of very libertarian worldview that has now become the default for people growing up and getting an education. It's like, what's your personal brand? Are you on brand? Are you, you're always selling yourself to the next employer.
Yeah.
Within
right.
this paradigm where we've all become every person who's really indoctrinated in neoliberalism has kind of become their own LLC.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, and that's true of me too. I mean, it's true of like academics are all supposed to be on Twitter, like pushing their, you know, and they're like generally good at it, but I mean, it's part of the, sort of part of the, it's a job requirement, especially if the younger you are, I think.
Yeah, so it's publish or perish has become like
tweet or perish.
Tweet or be terminated.
Yeah, tweet or termination, yeah. Can I ask you a basic question that I think kind of gets to the gist of the book?
Yeah.
Which I just made kind of turn from interrogative to declarative. But you say identifying what makes our moment unique or not is no easy task, in part because we are living in it and in part because the language we have to understand and describe our era's inequality is itself one of the instruments of perpetuating it. How can we think and act critically in the present when the very medium of the present, language, constantly betrays us? Speak on it. What is this betrayal?
Well, I mean, so that gets to the problem that's a distinctive feature of a lot of the words I talk about, which is that there are, you know, on one level, there are ways of just disguising people of wealth and the accumulation of wealth. But on the other hand, they are also terms that describe a certain kind of liberation, freedom. They describe like artistic practice or artistic work, you know, creativity being one of the kind of fundamental, I think, parts of the vocabulary of neoliberalism. And so you know, everywhere you turn, if you turn to, well, I'm going to escape the rat race by embracing art or something, you know, like that's something that might have once seemed like a way to avoid, you know, the culture of business, but that's now the language of business, you know, is like being a creative entrepreneur. And where empowerment is a word, which is a word that I talk about, you know, originates out of feminist movement and also out of the Black Power movement, which is, the Black Power is a kind of leads to the idea of empowerment to give working class and poor black people and give poor women in particular a sense of control over the kind of everyday oppressions and everyday labors of their lives that are not like addressed when you're talking in big picture terms about politics and so forth. I mean, that's where empowerment comes from. But now it's like a slogan for any kind of advertising product and any kind of political advertising product aimed at female consumers. So it's like everywhere you turn, what were once formerly safe kind of concepts or concepts that might lead you to a place of escape are just ways of routing you back into the work of making money.
Right. Well, it's like I just think immediately about watching. Well, for any creative, in the last 15 years to see the shift where my friends now say we are corporate creatives. So it just means that you make ads for companies. Like if you work for Vice, you're a corporate creative.
Do people self-identify as corporate creatives?
I think so. Yeah, in New York, absolutely. If you work for an ad agency, you know, if you're a photographer, but you're just out there shooting models, you're now the corporate creative. You're making the ads.
Yeah, I mean, the use of the noun form creative is,
yeah.
I mean, that, so like, that's the kind of thing that originally got me started on this. It was just, you know, a lot of people roll their eyes at that kind of thing. I mean, it's just like, it's annoying. And it's kind of glib and, you know, cutesy and stuff, but I guess, so that was sort of like the impetus for me starting is like, why is it annoying? Why is it so annoying to hear
creative
used in this way and to hear innovation used so ubiquitously? And that's kind of like why I started writing it.
Yeah, I think that empowerment is probably, if we were going to choose one for me personally, that's probably the word that I hate the most in terms of its commodification or co-optation or hijacking.
Yeah.
And it reminds me a bit of the Combahee River Collective, which are, you know, the people who, the black lesbians who started the, who came up with the term identity politics.
Right.
Which was intended to mean basically the opposite of what, of the way it's hijacked nowadays, at least by certain people. Most people, when they use it, and it's a hard thing to talk about because there's no common established definition of it, but empowerment as kind of an individualist, an individualistic, an individual uplift.
Right.
That actually goes against the collective uplift.
Mm-hmm.
And becomes kind of a tool of capitalism and not a tool against it.
Yeah, yeah. It's a word that's kind of like sustainability, which is another one I talk about in the book, in that it's like a description of what seems to be a rebellious or liberating practice. Yeah, but it's so relative in its meaning. So like empowerment just, you know, it doesn't mean power. It doesn't mean overpowering. It just means, well, you're slightly more empowered than you were yesterday, and sustainable just means more sustainable than something that's less sustainable. So none of these things like really look forward to any kind of like horizon that you could define or describe. It's just kind of less miserable than a more miserable thing, you know, or what they both kind of ultimately boil down to.
And do you see this, how much do you see this in like politics today or in the elections or the discussion about, I mean, I think of course all the time about the discussion of electoral politics, the presidential race.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, I mean, I've said this before on the show, but how there really was this schism between maybe left and liberal, and that's a whole other question about what we call these things, but there really was a kind of break between two camps, one of which is about like individual empowerment, how much you relate to someone's journey. You may be able to tell I'm a Bernie over Hillary person or a Bernie over Kamala person or Bernie over anyone else. But these two types of feminism and racial justice even, right? What happens is that people, I think, can conflate individual experience and the individual experience of someone who belongs to an oppressed group, that like de facto is the woke, progressive, rebellious thing.
Yeah.
Regardless of how it affects the less empowered, more powerless within that same group.
Yeah. And I mean, a common denominator with a lot of the language that that I talk about, and it's embraced, you know, in the kind of more orthodox, which is to say almost all the Democratic Party, for the reasons you just said, are these kinds of ways of thinking about, you know, economic success and wealth, but always in these kind of individualist terms, and never in any kind of, like, you know, there's no notion of solidarity that finds its way into my book, because there's no way you could kind of wrestle that into some form that would be accommodated with, like, just starting a business and becoming wildly successful by yourself. So there are all these words that are about, you know, individual success and individual achievement, individual overcoming, and so forth. And the assumption is always that that is sort of by default kind of good for the collective. I mean, you know, the Hillary Clinton example being a kind of obvious one, in which feminism is realized or something, and an individual's like ascent to a prominent position rather than in a set of policies that would, like, benefit a collective of people.
I just want all female or wardens for the prisons
to be women.
That would be the best.
Yeah, I agree. I want all, like, I want all lethal injection administrators to be women of color.
All drone pilots.
Yeah.
That would be the best for me.
I did do a little survey in 2016, and I did find, and you might appreciate this, that in, you know, the Bernie Sanders campaign website, under his economic policy, he never did once use the words innovation or entrepreneurship anywhere in the entire website. And, you know, the Hillary Clinton website, it was like they were going out of style. You know, they like every third word was innovation. So
was that because Bernie was too busy using slurs against women and people of color to fit any of those words in? You know, it's easy when you're a straight white man, it's easy to not shield rapists and sexual harassers.
Yeah, there weren't many words left over for him, so.
Yeah.
I have questions about your time in Detroit, too.
Oh, yeah.
Right? So what was that experience like, seeing the city going through everything it's going through and being a leftist academic?
Well, that's a long story, potentially.
Huge.
When we moved there in like 2007.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, like a really bad time. I mean, even by Detroit standards, I think a bad time. So, you know, in which the foreclosure crisis was really hitting the city hard, and there was no particular optimism about the future.
No hope or change possible.
Eric Allen was right.
Yeah, and you know, there was this sense, though, and it's the thing that I kind of that attracted me so much to the city, and that I kind of miss a lot, is because I feel like it's not as tangible anymore. Is the, you know, just like a sense of like shared hardship, shared struggle. We're all in this together. People who lived in Detroit were always like, we're really cared a lot about it, knew a lot about it. We're from, you know, almost in every case was from there, because why would you move there?
Right. Unless you're you.
Unless you're like a peculiar sort of person that got a job in this like strange, you know, institution there, like a hospital or a university or something. So, and then like it changed a lot, you know, in 2007, I remember making like jokes about gentrification, like how it could never happen, or how, like, at least I'm in a place where that'll never happen. And because, you know, the one thing you know about Detroit is there's so much empty space. And then fast forward 10 years and it's not a joke anymore. So the city's changed a lot. You know, it's more welcome to the kinds of fantasies about entrepreneurial heroism and so forth that I talk about than it was when I moved there. You know, that's like the kind of the big hope now, is through real estate entrepreneurs and private investment and new restaurants and so forth, there's a revival going on. I mean, I'm obviously very skeptical about it. And like in certain ways, you know, things have improved in certain ways, like the public lighting is better than it used to be. But
And can you talk about, I mean, one of the words that's always talked about, and you talk about the debate about this, is neoliberalism.
Yeah.
And does that qualify as a keyword or is that a buzzword?
Well,
and what do you think about its usefulness?
Well, it qualifies as a certain kind of keyword, not for me in terms of what the book's about, because neoliberalism is like inherently a critical word. And all of my terms I talk about in the book are like the vocabulary of capitalism rather than vocabulary against it. So, but, you know, neoliberalism, I was kind of reluctant to even get into it in the book, because I feel like there's a kind of long and kind of useless argument about, you know, whether you should say it, whether it means anything and whether it's proper to say it. And, basically my position is like, you know, who cares what term you use, if you are describing what you intend to describe. And, you know, there are people who will write these, you know, 10,000 word, essays in Dissent magazine or something about like how leftists should no longer say neoliberalism because of this and that. And which is, I think is like the most pointless, kind of exercise you could get into, because people will call things what they want to call things, whether you tell them to or not.
How do we talk about these things? Like, I mean, you talk about like capitalism, but it seems like there's this difficult thing to navigate, which is like, we're critiquing power.
Mm-hmm.
And what you're doing is critiquing power, and you're critiquing like the illusion of outside the box thinking.
Yeah.
That's actually very much inside the box. That's very like power perpetuating.
Yeah.
Which on a kind of meta level, it's like, okay, you're an academic, you're writing this book, and I'm not like crapping on the power of analysis or saying like you have to be out in the field or the factory to be part of an anti-capitalist struggle.
Mm-hmm.
But like, how does this work as a tool, this analysis? Is it prepping people to be more on guard about this stuff? Are you like pulling back a curtain on things? Is it just, does it have any material effect?
Yeah, well, that's a good question that I ask myself all the time, actually. And I don't know that I have a great answer for it, because, I mean, the answers that I would give would be some combination of everything you just said, I guess. I hope it gives people, you know, at like the most basic level, I hope that it gives people a sense of having their hatreds vindicated, you know, if people who hate hearing empowerment now can feel the satisfaction of knowing why they hate empowerment.
Right.
Which I don't think is, you know, nothing. I mean, there's something to being able to kind of arm yourself to go out into a kind of hostile world. But I also kind of hope that people who are, you know, broadly speaking of the left, will be kind of vigilant against, you know, smuggling in with some of these words, because some of these words aren't all just in Forbes magazine. They're also in like The Nation and other, you know, in like in the art world and so forth. And I hope people will be vigilant against smuggling in some of these kinds of private property worshiping, individualism venerating kind of concepts that that kind of cloud, I think, our political imagination. So like the stakeholder being one example of that, you know, a word that was coined by an anti-New Deal economist, a concept that's coined by an anti-New Deal economist to popularize the idea of a socially responsible corporation at a moment when people were making, you know, broad-based social and labor movements to hold corporations accountable. So stakeholderism is like a, you know, there's something sort of insidious about the idea that, well, we are all participants. We are all responsible for the success of this firm that's in our neighborhood because we're all stakeholders. And, you know, we're not. We're not all. We may be all stakeholders, but we don't all have the same stakes, you know. So,
yeah, I joined the New York City Teaching Fellows when I first moved to New York City. And was a hyper rugged individualist, pull yourself up by your bootstraps program, that basically was sending in college graduates to be union busters to some degree in the public school system. And, you know, I didn't see it that way when I joined, but now I do. And we were all indoctrinated with this very masochistic worldview of being everything was on our shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
So you as the foot soldier at the very bottom of the hierarchy and the pyramid in the education system are going to be a foot soldier for radically transforming these schools.
Yeah.
By not being engaged in the union, by being an innovator, and by really addressing the needs of all the stakeholders in the building. So it was super corporate language around, you know, using new tech and coming and thinking outside of the box to be an agent of change.
Yeah, and I mean, and to me, like, you know, maybe it's helped by being away and looking from afar, but, you know, the political moment in the United States is on one hand, you know, terrible, but on the other hand, in certain perverse ways, maybe more hopeful than I can ever remember being, in the sense that there is more of a, I think, a widespread, well, certainly a more widespread embrace of socialism than ever before in my lifetime, and in many years before that, but also just a bigger sense of like politics as a collective endeavor and as a something that is done through struggle, you know. And so my book might have like some small part to play in just sort of nurturing that sense, you know. I think at least like that's what I hope, and the increasing sense of skepticism and scorn for the elite, whether they're which regardless of what party they're from, but the, you know, the political and economic elite that are kind of hustling this language and these ideas of solitary work until you die, basically.
Right. Well, Katie's skimming through the book, and I immediately just saw human capital.
Yeah.
And also as a term that I always hated, but couldn't figure out exactly why. And then, you know, the breakdown of, you know, what the connotations of what that means when you think about, well, this person is worth this much, like to put a value on an individual.
Yeah.
And that's basically, it's like selling horses or selling people.
Yeah.
Like
and
an auction block.
The thing that amazed me about it, the history of that term, is that its initial inventors were like really worried about the fact that everybody would think of slavery when they heard the phrase human capital.
Yes, they should have been.
They're like, this is a problem. You know, unfortunately the word makes us think about slavery. And now that's not, no one really seems to be disturbed by that as much. I mean, I think you just said you were, and I was, but it's always remarkable to me how that word, it's so perverse, the phrase human capital. It's so creepy and it circulates so cheerfully, you know.
Yeah.
there's also, I mean, you talk about hegemony and also a sense of normal reality.
Yeah.
Which I think is something that's very much a question of language, right? Like, I think we can underestimate the power of words in politics and in material reality,
mm-hmm.
because they're just words, you know, who cares? I mean, there's a whole debate about words and power, but
yeah.
I do think just having terms for things makes them that much more acceptable
mm-hmm.
and that much more normal. And also, I mean, this whole thing about what's doable or feasible.
Yeah.
When you present things in a way that makes it sound like radical,
mm-hmm.
Like, I think personally that Obama said the public option on purpose because he wanted to scare people about it and
mm-hmm.
make it sound like gulaggy.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that the like vanillification of certain things, and again, like with Sanders, it's this it takes away from potential outrage. It like preempts outrage.
Yeah.
And I think that the pushing back on it is just calling things out, right? Like, these things that we talk about, human capital, or, you know, universal healthcare, universal coverage, what does that mean? It sounds great. It's universal
mm-hmm.
coverage. That's great. But no one wants to talk about, like, the nuts and bolts of it. So we just have this nice, touchy-feely, amorphous thing that people can point to and signal to.
Well, as long as there's still an employer's option.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, and like, you know, and as long as there's choice, that's another thing. You know, the as long as you have some choice in the marketplace, you are free to choose, and therefore, what are you complaining about? And the I do think that the power to name things is quite important. I think it's a power that the right wing is recognized more eagerly than anyone. You know, you think about all their great success stories in terms of laying claim to certain concepts, you know, right to work, death tax, all that stuff.
Yeah.
I was just thinking pro-life. About death tax.
Pro-life. Yeah, pro-life, right.
What is it, the clean air, whatever, their, like, pollution thing that they call clear air, clear skies or something?
I don't know
clean
that
air
one.
Act? Yeah.
I just know about good, clean, natural coal.
Natural coal, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, like, the history of innovation is sort of a product of anti-New Deal right-wingers trying to find a way to talk about the economy in a way that would nullify the word security and the words and the four freedoms that Roosevelt was so successful at promoting and during the Depression. So, you know, they would, sorry?
Can you remind people what those were?
Freedom from want.
Which translated into world terms means economic understandings which will secure to every nation a healthy peacetime life for its inhabitants everywhere in the world.
Freedom from fear.
Which translated into world terms means a worldwide reduction of armaments to such a point and in such a thorough fashion that no nation will be in a position to commit an act of physical aggression against any neighbor anywhere in the world.
And then two others, I can't remember.
The first is freedom of speech and expression everywhere in the world. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way everywhere in the world.
But the point was, like, for right-wingers in that period, they were, like, seriously on the defensive, and they were always kind of casting around for, like, how can we talk about big business in a way that will make people love big business again the way they did in the 20s? And, you know, it's funny to see how they were so angry about the word security, like as in social security, because it was so successful and people liked security. But it seemed to connote, you know, lazy, good for nothing, elderly people sitting around not working and so forth.
I love security too. That's why I like gated communities, the national security state apparatus.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, security has some. Security is not a pure word, but like, but innovation comes out of like how we need to make business sexy again, in a moment when it was widely reviled, and so like that's kind of where that, in a lot of ways, that's where that word comes from. And we're living in kind of the long aftermath of a successful campaign to, you know, to rebrand, if I may, the free market in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah. A thing that I always think about with language and power and stuff is like Marx saying, this is going to happen, right? There's going to be a revolution, mm-hmm. like communism's going to happen, socialism and communism. And also he says, workers of the world, unite, right?
Mm-hmm.
You have nothing to lose but your chains.
Mm-hmm.
And so the role of language in the material world and in shaping reality,
mm-hmm.
these things are, as much as we kind of dismiss intellectualism as hoity-toity and analysis, I mean, there are two things. One is I think they are powerful. We see someone like, and you don't have to be a straight white man to use them, like Fidel Castro used them. There's this interesting, like, is that a contradiction of Marx, or is that an example of Marxism? Is he pretending to be more of a social scientist than he is an agitator?
Well, I think he talks in the manifesto. Well, they Engels and Marx write in the manifesto.
Yeah,
they do write in the manifesto about a role for the intellectual, and they do talk about. I mean, Marx talks about to a small degree talks about language as being something that itself has to be revolutionized in order to do the work of analyzing the world. So, he says at the beginning of Capital, we couldn't spare the reader some complicated new terms because the old terms are a product of the society that we're aiming to overthrow. So you can't really separate the work of analysis in his terms from the work of political organization. I mean, and he's, the famous line, philosophers have only interpreted the world, the real purpose is to change it, I think it's correct and worth remembering. So I don't think that for him they would be separate things.
Right. Just giving you an opening, by the way. So, your next interview, you can be like, well, I like to consider myself the Karl Marx of the 21st century. I actually do think that's what I think about, because I think sometimes the left can be in this very annoying virtue signaling way, kind of dismissive of intellectualism and theory.
And I think it's kind of an American thing also.
It was a great book because it put all of these words that irritate me in one place. So I could see them all there, and it was kind of, once you see them in this book, now when I walk around outside, the keywords sort of glow, like there's a highlighter that's been put under all of them.
So you're sort of like Rowdy Piper in They Live, walking around?
This, dude, look, you gotta get John Pat Leary's keywords. A new language of capitalism. And this book acts like a pair of Ray-Bans that you can put on, brother. And man, you'll see the reptiles. You'll see them.
Were there any words that didn't make it that you wanted to add in, but you didn't have the time or the page numbers to include that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yes, and now I'm struggling to remember what they were. Shit, what were they?
If you forget them, you can call in.
There was a budgetary constraints, so we didn't get a complete list of all of the words you need to see and identify before you get to full liberation.
Yeah.
So that sounds like book two.
The
sequel. And anything you want to just leave with listeners with, like any things that you want them to be particularly vigilant of, like a top five maybe?
The top five, like the worst, top five worst words?
Yeah, most dangerous or most annoying,
I think most annoying and most dangerous, because to me, those are kind of synonymous, I think. Is passion. Passion might be my least favorite, just because, it's such a potentially good word that's been kind of abused so much. And
I agree with that one.
We passionately agree with that.
Yeah. Creative is particularly terrible. I mean, whether in the noun form that Gabe was using or just as an adjective to describe the creative economy. And then just like innovation. I mean, innovation is that's the mother of all of these words. It's the where it all started, because I was walking around and like seeing innovation everywhere and trying to figure out why this stupid word that didn't really mean anything and was being just kind of thrown around so widely, the vagueness of it first irritated me. And then the way that it's kind of celebrated just wealth and profit making as this kind of like prophetic kind of spiritual endeavor really offended me. But yeah, I mean, to me, like part of the pleasure of working on this, because it's at times been like really irritating and really demoralizing to read Forbes.com and the Harvard Business Review.
Can I say something though?
Yeah,
you showed a lot of grit.
You took my line. Yeah,
thanks.
Following through.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, there's no like everywhere you turn, it's
really disruptive. Provide a lot of data.
But yeah, what was I saying before you disrupted my shit game?
This was a long road, and there were a lot of peaks and valleys.
Yeah,
valleys
right.
And peaks.
But you know, the power of sharing your contempt for something is something I've really come to appreciate.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's very important.
From working on this.
There's a lot of solidarity there. I really think that's true.
Yeah, I think that's where, at least it's one of the major places where solidarity comes from is a shared hatred of something or somebody.
Yeah.
So,
besides Donald Trump.
Yeah, so.
Not that we're fans of his, but that's not, I think some libs think that that's how we're going to change the world. By celebrating our hatred of him.
Yeah, yeah, Cheeto, just making fun of him.
Like it's like impotently complaining about a sitcom that you don't like.
Yeah, that is what.
Really,
yeah, that is what it's like.
And also that everyone who loves that sitcom just loves more every time they hear it attacked.
Yeah, like it seems like there's this anger towards him that doesn't necessarily translate to wanting to affect change in terms of structure or policies.
Right, as long as we get rid of him.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Things will be better if we get rid of the orange monster.
Exactly.
And as long as we get the norms back.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The language, the suits, not the orange skin. I mean, I'm on this list where people are like, speaking of language, they're like, we need to brand. We need a name for him because he's so good at those things, you know, lying Ted.
Yeah.
Crooked Hillary, Crazy Bernie. And all these people are trying to come up with these names for him, like Don the Con. And it's like they just seem like uncool parents.
Yeah,
trying to rap.
Wasn't
like,
there
a freestyle battle?
Didn't the Democratic Party come up with something like really corny? Like maybe it was during the election, but it was something like Devious Donald or like.
like sounds like a great garbage.
Yeah, it was some. It was some like you know alliteration with D, like dumb
right.
Donald, something
Dreadful.
Like that. Yeah, dreadful ton.
When he called him Grump, that was like the lowest point. That they
yeah, maybe we can just or say his name in a Russian accent. Or turn the R. I'm surprised people haven't done that. Turn the R around in Trump.
Oh, they have done that. I've seen.
Oh, they have?
I've seen mugs for sale with that.
Oh.
Yeah.
Dude,
somebody is capitalizing. Someone's really. That's an innovation right there.
But that's a great.
Well, it is an innovation. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a great example of language, right? Because as long as you use the correct words, you can have Trump's policies. As long as you're respectful and have decorum and use the right words, and we'll just come back with someone like George Bush.
Yeah.
And as long as you're not using vulgar words, you'll be fine.
Yeah. And I mean, those kinds of, you know, polite words that that characterize like the norms that some people miss so much are, you know, they're just like ways of evading what we should actually be talking about.
Yeah. I think it's really important sometimes to really get a consultant in there to help find, you know, fissure points where we can see the redundancies.
Yeah.
And perhaps make a reduction in our human capital to maximize.
Yeah.
Yeah. The redundancies, those poor redundancies.
Maybe talk to human resources.
Yeah.
I mean, human resources is also a creepy
yeah.
term for the same reason that human capital
personnel,
is.
Right?
What's that?
Wasn't it called, it used to be called personnel?
Yeah, and human resources is supposed to make it sound more loving and caring and respectful of the people that are what really make a company work, you know?
Right.
It suggests to me, it suggests, you know, it should suggest the total opposite of that.
Human resources is kind of like the reverse bizarro world version of having a union rep.
Yeah.
Instead of going to your union rep to talk about your issues, you have to go to human resources to get psychologically evaluated and fired.
Right.
To get made redundant. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then meritocracy, of course, is our favorite. Hamilton meets Hillary meets One Shot.
Yeah. And meritocracy is such a weird one because it was originally coined actually as a criticism of the idea of meritocracy that people now celebrate. So it was coined as a combination of merit and aristocracy, and it was coined as a joke, and now it's been embraced as representing the very thing it was trying to criticize in the first place. It's like one of the, you know, all-time kind of failed satirical ventures.
So, you know, some of this sort of shows me that the late capitalism is a little bit like The Thing from the horror movie, where it can take any of these terms and, you know, digest them and then sort of reappropriate them and spit them out as a simulation of the benign, like, you know, what it was.
Yeah.
But it's just a benign face to this sort of parasitic monster.
Yeah, that's totally what it is. Yeah, sucking like sort of vital fluids out of something and then spitting out the like husk. Yes, that is kind of how it works.
Because when we say choice, like I just think about, you know, I go see Black Panther, which is a, you know, celebration of Black empowerment, I guess. And then, you know, where they're, you know, T'Challa kills Killmonger, who's like the only real radical, and he sides with the white CIA agent. But before the movie even starts, there's an ad for like Coca-Cola, and it's an empowered young white woman strutting down the street, and she has the choice of what color can she wants her Coca-Cola to come in. But it feels so like extra empowering until you get to the moment where you see that the whole slam poem that she's presenting is about what color Coke can.
Wait, so what are the options?
You know, you can get like a nice magenta or like a purple, like an orange, you know, like a tangerine color can. It's great. It's great.
So, yeah, I mean,
that's the world we live in. It's like what flavor, what color can do you want your soft drink to come in?
Yeah.
And like at the end of Black Panther, when the way that movie imagines the revolutionary like transformation is just sort of opening a nonprofit to like teach coding or something. And
right? It's like code or die for the, Oakland, underprivileged kids in Oakland.
Yeah. And it's, if I saw it right and I remembered it right, it was also in the very abandoned public housing building where the film started, wasn't it?
That's right. Yeah.
So we're replacing public housing with like learn to code or some shit like that. Yeah. And that's like how the movie imagines, you know, radical social change happening.
That's liberation.
Yeah. So, I mean, I couldn't, that kind of knocked me out when I saw that. So it's a good example. That's a good example of the thing operating that you're talking about.
When reading this book, I think of capitalism as not, it's an ideology, but it's also ideologies have a religious component to them. And, you know, it's just the biggest cult.
Yeah.
And I'm reading this book and I'm thinking about Scientology and Going Clear and how, you know, the way that you indoctrinate people into a belief system is that you give them a new vocabulary, a new lexicon that doesn't expand the possibilities in their imagination, but reduces them and sort of frames the conversation.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that's why, I'm praising this book and I think people should read it for that, to see the prison that we've created, the matrix of language, the linguistic matrix of capitalism is clearly outlined in this book.
Yes.
Well, thank you.
And it reminds me of, just a final thought, it reminds me of, what's the line, and not to quote The Usual Suspects as a major part of the canon or anything, but what is it, the biggest trick the devil ever played was to convince people he didn't exist?
Yes.
Right.
So it's like the biggest trick capitalism ever played was to convince people it wasn't an ideology.
Yeah.
It was
right.
Just a thing. Like, it's just a system. Same thing with free market. Like, it's just there and we all know it's not, and that there's all this intervention.
Right.
But like, we're the ideologues and they're the pragmatists.
Right.
Allegedly.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that's fraying more and more than it, than I can remember. And that's why I'm like weirdly optimistic, even though I'm glad that I don't live in the United States right now also.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for this robust, passionate, leading, innovating.
Inclusive.
Grit.
Oh yeah, inclusive would be a good one. I didn't talk about that one though.
Oh yeah, so that's one of the ones that's missing. Very competent conversation that was just very well curated, and there was a lot of it was very engaging.
Well, the curation was all you guys, so thank you.
Thank you.
That's thanks. We're nimble curators.
Yeah, and thanks for your resilience, and thanks so much for sharing. Thanks for sharing this. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very smart. Well, solutions.
Well, thank you for sharing.
You're a thought leader.
Where do we find you? Give us your Twitter.
At John Pat Leary, JohnPatLeary.
Do you have a website? Do you have anything else you need us to plug?
The website is keywordsforcapitalism.com.
Everybody get it. Can they get it on Audible yet?
I don't know. I don't think so.
All right. We got to work on that.
Yeah, work on that. And it's a Haymarket Books.
Here go, guys.
You can get it cheaper from Haymarket than from Amazon. So get it from them.
Don't support Amazon.
Awesome.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. It was so fun.
Yours. Yeah.
Thanks,
get
man.
Good to see you again, Gabe. Haven't seen you in a while.
It's been a while. I'll come visit you in Portugal.
I know. Let's do a live taping of the show in Lisbon. I love Lisbon.
Nah, the best.
The best.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Bye. Also, very exciting news about John Pat Leary is he is now a columnist at the New Republic, so make sure you check out his essays there. Also, make sure that you follow him on Twitter, where he is John Pat Leary, JohnPatLeary. And, of course, buy Keywords. Thanks so much for listening to The Katie Halper Show. You can hear The Katie Halper Show on iTunes and SoundCloud, and please rate and review us on iTunes. Of course, you can find extra material, bonus episode, extended interviews at patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. Again, that's patreon.com/TheKatieHalperShow. Make sure you become Patreon supporters so you can hear John explaining why he wrote the book and reading some of his favorite terms from the book. The Katie Halper Show is edited by Ted Reedy. Our theme song is by the band Cordova.
This episode sponsored by Ridwell. Doing the right thing shouldn't be so hard, but when it comes to recycling, it often is. Ridwell makes it simple to recycle more from anywhere. With Ridwell, you can recycle plastic bags, snack wrappers, pill bottles, bottle caps, and other items your curbside bin doesn't take. And unlike most recycling programs, Ridwell carefully tracks where your items go and reports back on what actually gets recycled. Getting started is easy. Order a starter kit, fill the bags with hard-to-recycle items, send them back for free, and Ridwell takes care of the rest. Start today at ridwell.com.